Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jeff Pagliuca. I represent Ms. Spector. Ms. Spector is a young public defender who was representing a defendant in a very serious and complicated case in El Paso County. The case proceeded to motions and then to trial, and during the trial, Ms. Spector was held in direct contempt by the trial court. There are four reasons that this court should reverse the finding of direct contempt, and the first two would be dispositive if the court were to rule on either of those. The first, Your Honors, is that the judgment of contempt in this case was flawed procedurally. And it's a very simple procedural flaw, and that is there was an inadequate warning in this case to invoke the direct contempt provisions of Rule 107. Ms. Spector was asking questions of a witness, a Detective Foote. It related to some 404B evidence from Florida. Ms. Spector was attempting to elicit some answers related to the police investigation. On objection by the prosecution, the trial court indicated, in my view, very vague terms, that the trial court wasn't going to consider what I will call hearsay testimony. Ms. Spector attempted once to rephrase, then twice to rephrase, and then was held in contempt. And the precise question that she attempted to rephrase ended up being a half partial question with really no question being asked. And it was when that rephrasing occurred that the trial court said, "You're in violation, I'm going to hold you in direct contempt." And that essentially was the finding of the court at that point in time. The law in Colorado and elsewhere requires that there be some form of warning for a lawyer to be held in direct contempt for a violation of court orders.
Didn't she receive prior warnings in this trial?
Well, that's a very good question, Your Honor. And she received warnings, but I don't call those warnings, certainly not for asking this question.
And well, for instance, if I warn you right now that I'm going to hold you in direct contempt if you continue to argue some point, and so you stop, okay, and you come on later and you argue another point, and I say, don't argue that point, and you persist in arguing it, is the warning I gave you the first time sufficient to cover this one, or must I give you another such warning?
I think the latter is true, Your Honor, and there's a reason for that, especially in the context of this type of case. This is a trial. This is a jury trial. And we all walk into courtrooms understanding that we have professional responsibilities and that we are supposed to abide by the rules of evidence, clearly. I take that as a given, that when we go into a courtroom, we know that one of the orders of the court, unstated, is that we abide by the rules of evidence. But judges and lawyers have different views of how those rules are applied and what is or is not an acceptable question. This is a dynamic process where I don't believe that a court can say, you must abide by all of my orders, whatever they may be, and that's a blanket statement that then sets up a holding of direct contempt. And that's essentially what happened here. There are a series of issues, I'm going to jump forward because in large part, this is backfilling by the trial court. And the trial court, I think, looked at its order sort of after the trial court had calmed down and after there had been some briefing in the trial court about what the propriety of the contempt holding was. And the trial court, I think, then essentially said, gee, I'm not so sure about my holding. I'm going to come up with other reasons why this young lady was held in direct contempt. But the direct answer to your question, in my opinion, is there needs to be a specific warning, particularly when it relates to a criminal trial where a trial lawyer is attempting to fulfill her Sixth Amendment obligation, her effective assistance of counsel obligation to a defendant. The question is a good one because, for example, if you were to say to me, Judge Roy, Mr. Pagliuca, don't ask that a hearsay question, I would understand that. I would say, okay, I'm not going to. I'm going to ask a question that doesn't call for a hearsay response, i.e. that the truth of the matter asserted is what I'm trying to elicit. I'm attacking a police investigation, so the question I'm going to ask as a setup is going to be, Detective Foote, you're in charge of this investigation. Isn't that true? Yes. And as the detective in charge of this investigation, you oversaw all of the information that was presented to your agents. Yes, I did. And you reviewed all of those reports. Yes, I did. And isn't it true that nowhere in those reports is any statement of the assailant being a black man, which was the issue that was trying to be gotten out here? Yes, that's true. And if there had been any such statement, you would have investigated that, wouldn't you have, detective? Yes, I would have. I think that's a perfectly appropriate exchange. It doesn't call for a hearsay response. I don't think there's a good objection in there. And if this question had been allowed to proceed, I believe that had the court not allowed it, it would have been reversible error. That's exactly what Ms. Spector was trying to do. She never got there because the court simply jumped on her and held her in direct contempt. So that's my answer to your question, Your Honor. The second issue is that this contempt was flawed substantively. I think I've just addressed that. Attempting to rephrase a question as a matter of law should not be something a lawyer could be held in direct contempt for, particularly when we're talking about a criminal trial where the punishment for the defendant upon conviction is life in prison. A lawyer has an obligation to rephrase questions, and the case law from all of our appellate courts is replete with, if you don't ask the question, you waive it, and you don't get to argue it on appeal. And that's something that a trial lawyer has to do. And if you're prevented from doing that by the court, you're unable to do your job as a trial lawyer.
Counsel, that sweeps too broadly. If the court says don't ask a particular kind of question, you don't get to ask it. I mean, your remedy at that point is the appeal. You've made your record. The objection's been sustained.
I agree.
So I think what you're saying is, it sounded like what you were saying was, if the court gives you a ruling you don't like, you might have some ethical obligation to disobey it because of what's at stake.
Absolutely not. If the court gives you a clear order, a clear and direct order, you are not allowed to ask X question, my remedy is with the Court of Appeals. I agree with that. But when the court says, in essence, you're not allowed to ask a question that elicits a hearsay response, that is an open invitation by the court to ask a follow-up question that doesn't elicit a hearsay response. And that's precisely what happened here. So I agree exactly with you, Your Honor. If I get a direct order, I understand what I need to do. But there was no direct order here that applied to this particular question, this set of facts.
Well, the rules prohibit the hearsay question.
Absolutely.
I mean, the court order is surplusage to
absolutely. However, as you well know, the exceptions to the hearsay rule greatly overtake the rule. And the series of questions that I was posing hypothetically is the precise way that one would get to where Ms. Spector was trying to get had she not been held in direct contempt by the court prematurely and inappropriately.
Counsel, I'd like to go back just for a second and follow up on Judge Roy's question about the warnings. At the end of this whole colloquy, when the court ultimately first says, I'm finding you in contempt, the first thing he says was, you again disregarded the order of the court. And then later on, he says, this is the third time at least. Do we have any idea at that point what those prior times were?
No.
And what do we know what that's all about?
Well, certainly at the time this was happening, we don't know that, Your Honor.
Even later on.
Yes, what has happened post hoc is the court has gone through the record and tried to pick out instances where the court claims that Ms. Spector violated a court order. And I have addressed those in detail, I think, in both the opening and the reply briefs. But the best, there are two very good examples, I think, of this post hoc determination. The first relates to the issue about jury selection. It is curious that the court's jury selection order, the court is relying on as one of the prior orders, wasn't entered until the day after jury selection. And it is further curious that that the actual written form order itself wasn't placed into the court file until July 27th, which was the day of the sentencing hearing. So to suggest that that is an order that Ms. Spector knowingly violated is really a stretch. And that's the kind of backfilling that's being done here. Because after the contempt finding, and I was the counsel of record in the trial level, I filed a series of motions challenging the direct contempt finding. And I think that based on those motions, it became obvious that this was a tenuous finding. And so then we had, in my view, revisionist history of what happened during the trial. The other two points that I want to try to make relate to the trial judge himself sitting in this case in the contempt proceeding. After the contempt finding, there were not one but two motions to disqualify the court. Those were amply supported, sufficiently supported, and this judge simply was too embroiled in this controversy to conduct any further proceedings related to Ms. Spector's sentencing. And the fourth point simply is that the entire sentencing hearing in this case was a gross violation of Ms. Spector's due process. A day before the hearing was to occur, the trial court entered an order essentially expanding the scope of the sentencing hearing and taking it from, you asked a question that I told you not to ask, that elicited a hearsay response, to the entire trial. And then during the sentencing hearing, the court commented on other trials that Ms. Spector had that the court disapproved of.
Isn't that appropriate for sentencing? Might not be appropriate for a finding of contempt, but isn't that appropriate for sentencing?
I say no, Your Honor, number one.
Well, I understand you say no, but why?
Well, because the court is now, well, because first we look at Rule 107, there's a specific requirement for direct contempt, which dispenses with due process. And that is, here is what you're being held in contempt for. This is it, right here. And what the court said on the record was this asking of this question. When we get to the sentencing hearing, it is not only that, it is the conduct during the entire trial, conduct in other trials, and comments made by other judges. Ms. Spector had absolutely no notice of any of that and no opportunity to refute any of it, which she could have done. And that's the problem, because the trial court combined a direct contempt finding with an indirect contempt proceeding in which the trial judge was both the investigator and the sentencer, which is inappropriate under Rule 107.
He also barred her from his courtroom, is that correct?
He did.
Permanently?
I'm not sure what the current status of that is, Your Honor. He barred her the day on the 15th is when he barred her from his courtroom, which is another reason why, in my mind, this judge demonstrated the inability to be unbiased as it related to Ms. Spector. I see I have about 2 minutes left, and I'd like to reserve those for rebuttal. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Doyle Baker. I'm a deputy district attorney from the 4th Judicial District in Colorado Springs, and my bar registration number is 22277. Who's in charge of the courtroom? That question is the essence of this appeal. And I don't think that either side would disagree that ultimately it's the judge who's in charge. But I think that Ms. Spector has put herself in a position where she has to attack the way the judge conducted this trial, and she has to essentially put him on trial for his attempts to keep control of what happened in the courtroom.
Baker?
Yes.
I'm going to jump right to the question that Ms. Spector was initially held in contempt for. What is your view of the order that she violated? What was the court's specific order?
Judge, to answer that question, I need to give you a little bit of context, not just surrounding that order, but two other instances of what occurred before we got to that point. starting with the jury selection.
No, I'm going to go there.
Okay.
The court held her in contempt for a specific partial question and said that that partial question violated his order. I want to know what the order was. I don't want to hear about jury selection. That's a separate issue.
If you go to the transcript, which is from the June 11th portion of the trial, when this detective was on the stand, there were five instances where Ms. Spector attempted to ask him for statements from witnesses who were not present and would not testify at trial.
Hearsay.
Well,
statements by other people to the detective.
Yes, that was the objection.
Okay. And how did this question run afoul of that? How was it calling for a statement at all?
The question that she asked was if the Florida witness had said to anybody under your investigation, and at that point, Judge Kennedy cleared the courtroom, she was asking for a statement that was said by anybody.
She's asking if, not what a statement was, if anybody had told you. That doesn't call for a statement by anybody, much less a hearsay response.
Well, I think it assumes, Your Honor, that a statement was made to this.
Many questions assume statements were made that don't call for a hearsay response. It's only when you ask, what did so-and-so say to you, that you have a hearsay problem. How did this question do that?
You can say if
it's the negative side of the question. If someone had told you this, what would you have done?
Right.
That's what she was asking. If someone had told you this, what would you have done? Or if no one told you this, what did you do?
Unfortunately, we're not certain what she was, where she was going with that for sure. Because,
well, isn't that part of the problem?
Isn't the contempt premature?
I'm sorry.
Isn't the contempt premature? And she never finished the question. And her counsel's argument about how that question would have been completed, and from my understanding, her statements about how that question would have been completed, was not a hearsay question.
Well, that may be. However, this is what the court said immediately before she tried to ask that question. The court has previously entered an order. There will be no questions regarding statements made to Mr. Hayden. Now, the judge did the same thing to the defendant or the prosecutor on direct examination. He asked a question that called for the response of a witness who was not there. There was an objection from Ms. Spector that this was hearsay. The prosecutor told the judge, we're not offering this for the truth of the matter asserted. And the judge told the prosecutor, stay away from statements from third parties who are not going to testify here. He did the same thing immediately before
the victim in this case, the victim
question.
In the case that was being considered did not testify here.
The victim in this case was deceased at the time of trial.
No, I mean, we're talking about 404B evidence,
right?
We're not,
right?
We're talking about the Florida incident. That victim testified, didn't they? Didn't she?
She did testify. And I don't think any of the statements that Ms. Spector was soliciting were statements from that victim. There was a friend of the victim. There was a doctor who examined the victim.
But the statements that were made to him by the victim were permitted.
I believe that's correct.
For the purposes of treatment, it was not. Have I got the wrong case?
Those are the statements to the doctor in the emergency room.
The doctor, statements to the doctor in the emergency room and the nurse in the emergency room were permitted. And Dr. Hayden was that doctor, was he not?
Your Honor, I believe that pages 254 and 255 of that 611 transcript, the court is clarifying with her. She's asking a question, and the court says, "Who is this statement from? Is this Dr. Hayden, or Dr. Hayden's statement, or the detective?" And when it came out that it was Dr. Hayden's statement, the top of 255, court says, the objection is sustained. There'll be no further questions regarding statements made by the victim to witness who's not present and subject to cross-examination. So, no, to the extent that statements, that she was eliciting statements from the doctor, those were not allowed. Now, whether the court was correct on its interpretation of the hearsay rule or not is really not the question. The court's instruction to both prosecution and defense counsel was, don't get into statements of third parties who are not here.
Counsel, if the question asked did not call for a statement by a third party, would you agree with me that the contempt finding based on that question cannot be upheld?
Yes, because the court's instruction was ask no further questions about statements made by third parties. And then Ms. Spector's question was, which was cut off, was if anybody had said, or if the victim had said to anybody that was under your investigation. Now, maybe she was speculating about whether somebody had said that. Maybe she had information that she was going to offer that somebody had said that, but
she's positing a negative. She's positing a negative. She's positing something that didn't occur. She's positing that it didn't occur. Now, what would have happened if that had not occurred, or what would happen if that had occurred? Those are not hearsay questions.
I think hearsay involves an assertion of the truth of the matter, and I think that a statement that is not made under certain circumstances could be asserted for the truth of the matter, the fact that you don't say something. And if what Mr. Paglucchia is saying is correct, she was attempting to solicit that nobody had told this detective that a black man was involved in this incident, that could be hearsay, in that if they're not saying, if there's no statement that a black man was involved, it's being offered for the truth of the matter, which is a black man was not involved.
Counsel, if I ask the question of a witness, did you ask anyone about whether a black man was involved in this assault? Okay, I think you'd agree with me that that's not a problematic question from a hearsay standpoint, correct?
Well, you're asking the witness on the stand if he asked that question.
Okay, yeah, exactly. It's only when I ask the question, did Mr. Smith tell you that a black man was involved in the assault? That calls for hearsay.
Well, okay. You would violate the court's order, certainly.
Yes, but we don't have a question like that here. The question here was, if someone had told you such and such, presumably that a black man was involved, would you have been looking for a black man? I mean, this is pretty basic hearsay stuff. It just doesn't sound like hearsay to me. It's not calling for a statement by anybody about anything. It's not a statement at all.
Well, it's hard to say for sure where she was going with it, since the judge ended the...
Well, if it's hard to say for sure where she was going with it, how can the judge hold her in contempt?
Because he had told her, stay away from statements.
So he's making an assumption. I mean, he doesn't know where she's... So he holds her in contempt based upon an assumption of where he thinks the question is going. And you think that's okay?
Well, again, the question is, if the victim had said to anybody, now, maybe she's speaking hypothetically, like I said, maybe she had information that the victim did in fact speak to a witness who wasn't there. I think at that point, the judge felt like she was going down the same road. And the record will show, I guess, what the record shows on that.
Let's put it a little more simply. If she asked the broad question, did anybody tell you or tell anybody else that you know of that a black man was involved in the assault, is it your view that that calls for hearsay?
It's calling for a yes or no answer.
Right. It's not calling for a statement by anybody.
I believe it would be. She's trying to get at what third parties are reporting.
She's trying to get at what an officer knows, and based upon what he knows, how he investigates the case. But that doesn't mean that everything he knows or the way you inquire into what he knows necessarily calls for hearsay. You can inquire as to what an officer knows without getting into that. Seems to me that's what she was doing. She's trying to comply.
Well, part of the problem, I guess, is also that Judge Kennedy did not phrase his instructions to her in terms of hearsay. Certainly there are statements from third parties that aren't hearsay, dependent on the circumstances under which they're offered. But Judge Kennedy said, let's stay away from anything that third parties said or might have said.
No. Let's be fair. He said anything that was said by somebody who's not available to testify.
Okay.
No statements. And how does this question call for such a response?
She's asking again for something that the victim in Florida might have said to somebody else. And it may not be hearsay, but it is. She's looking for a statement that was made by somebody who...
She's not asking him, though, tell me what so-and-so said.
No, well, we're not sure where she was going with it, frankly. I mean...
That gets us back to another question. If we're not sure, how can we affirm the contempt?
I'm sorry, Judge, could you...
If we're not sure what the question would have been, how can we affirm the finding of contempt?
I think that you affirm the finding of contempt, you have to affirm it or deny it based on the record you have. And frankly, I'm not sure I can say anything more than I've said about the record at this point that hasn't been said already.
Okay, let me follow up on that a little bit. And does this case rise or fall on the correctness of a finding of contempt on this one question? Because the judge came back later on and by my count listed at least 7, maybe more things, including arguing with the judge as a basis for contempt. So do those just go out the window because she just didn't have any notice of those?
I think certainly the record reveals a history of issues there.
Well, there may be a history, but the question is, the argument that Ms. Spector is making is the first time she heard that any of those were the basis for finding a contempt was at the sentencing hearing, and she was told she didn't even have an opportunity to argue those.
And I would disagree with that, and I would point, Your Honor, to several points in the record. When the coroner was questioned and Ms. Spector brought out the fact that there were drugs in the victim's system when she died, at that point, this was also in the transcript from June 11th, I believe at page 12, the court stopped and he said, you've violated a direct order from me not to get into that. And at that point, he also referenced the violation of the case management order during jury selection.
Did he find her in contempt at that point?
Pardon me?
Did he find her in contempt?
He did not find her in contempt at that point. He warned her, however, that any further violations of court orders would result in contempt. And certainly...
But that takes us back to this hearsay, supposed hearsay question.
Hearsay. Yeah. And okay. Again, the ultimate... the point at which she was found in contempt was, again, the fifth point at which he had told her, don't ask those type of questions. There were 4 previous instances immediately before that. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
I want to briefly touch on this hearsay issue. Not only does the question not elicit a statement, importantly, it has to be offered for the truth of the matter asserted, and it clearly was not. And we have dozens, if not hundreds, of situations in civil and criminal cases where the question is intended to ask why someone did what they did. The most obvious example of this, which happens all the time in criminal cases, is, officer, why did you go to that address? Well, I got a call from dispatch telling me to go there. Were you looking for anyone in particular? Yes, I was looking for a man with a blue ski mask and red tennis shoes. Well, why were you looking for that person? Because dispatch said that the caller said that the assailant was a man with blue ski mask and green tennis shoes. That happens hundreds of times, and it's not, as much as I object to it, I am overruled in the trial court and in this court on that objection. And the response is, it's to show why the officer did what the officer did. Now, sometimes that's relevant and sometimes it's not. But when you're talking about why someone did a specific thing, it certainly is relevant, and that's the response that always happens. So this is patently not hearsay.
All right, but to be fair, it does appear that the trial court's ruling wasn't necessarily limited to hearsay. It's a bit unclear. He seems to have gone a little bit broader and said statements by somebody who's not available to testify. And now, admittedly, some of those statements might not be hearsay for the reasons you're pointing out, but the way he phrased it wasn't necessarily in terms of hearsay.
Well, and that's another problem, because it's the job of the judge to articulate a clear enough order so that it can be followed. If you're going to be holding somebody in direct contempt, the order has to be sufficiently clear that you can follow it. The order was, at first, it was not to inquire into statements made to a person who is not present and subject to cross-examination. And that was the initial order. And then there was a further narrowing.
Which is narrower than the hearsay rule. I mean, it's based on the people.
I mean, frankly, I don't know what it means. That's the other problem. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for the briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.